Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
My first guest for you today is Leanne Bissett. Leanne is a physiotherapist, and she's conducted important research into the treatment of tennis elbow. But my God, that doesn't even scratch the surface of Leanne's extraordinary life. Leanne has lived for years in villages in Thailand, and she's lived the life of a local there. She's treated leprosy patients in Thailand, and she's worked in the Olympic Village during the Sydney 2000 Games. In 1989, Leanne was working as a physio on the New South Wales Central Coast and loving it. But just when you think life is going one way, something happens. Because one day in that year, Leanne caught a bus from Gosford to the Gold Coast to visit her parents. And then as the bus was going past Grafton, a semi-trailer collided into it and killed many of the passengers. And after you survive a crash like that, you never see life quite the same way again. Your life in Thailand started off with you as an exchange student when you're 15 years old. Where did you go in Thailand?
I was based right up in the north of Thailand initially in a little village called Dok Kom Thai, which is up in a province called Piao, in the far northeast of Thailand.
I noticed your Thai accent's pretty good too there.
Oh, it's not anymore. The Thais would be horrified. I used to be able to speak conversational Thai, at least, you know, fairly fluently when I came back, because up there no one spoke English. I was pretty much the only white person in that village.
Well, you just dropped into it. Did you have anyone that spoke English there?
No, not at all. When we went over, there were 20 Australian students who went over this year, and it was 1983, so it's a long time ago now. And we arrived in Bangkok, and we had 2 weeks of orientation in Bangkok where they basically gave us a basic grounding in Thai, and then they shipped us off to our families. So my Thai family didn't speak English, and the schools, you know, they teach English, but it's very basic, and it's still, even the English teachers weren't at the time necessarily fabulous with their English. So apart from an American Peace Corps worker who'd been there a few years before, they hadn't had anyone live in that town.
You must have freaked out for a couple of days at least, being in that environment.
Oh, it took longer than a couple of days to settle. I think I had culture shock for about the first 6 months.
6 months?
Yeah. There.
What did it mean for you living in a little Thai village like that?
My entire life was different. Everything you can possibly imagine that you do in your day-to-day living was thrown on its head when I went there. So nothing was the same. The toilets aren't the same. The showers and baths aren't the same.
How do you take a bath there? How do you actually take a bath?
They have big bowls of water, and you basically stand, and it's a tiled bathroom, or my family's bathroom was tiled, and you stand on the floor and you scoop the water out and you throw it over yourself, then you soap yourself up and then you scoop the water out and throw it back over yourself. So it's a wet bathroom, like everything's wet. Nothing's dry. You stand on the floor and the whole thing gets wet, basically. So everything was different. Of course, the food, the language, the culture, the customs, everything.
You learned sword fighting?
I did. It was a year out of my normal academic education, so because it didn't count towards my academic marks here, I basically could do what I liked. So I did flower arranging and sword fighting, and I learnt to play a Thai musical instrument, and cooking.
What clicked? How did you get past the culture shock and start to? Do you remember that moment where you started to actually pick up the rhythm of day-to-day life in this village?
I think a big part of it was learning the language. And it was a very steep learning curve, and probably the first 3 months were really intense in that respect, like trying to grasp what was going on with the language. And I had my own, the school gave me a dedicated teacher to teach me to read and write Thai, but the first day, I remember the first day I sat there with her, and this poor woman had never taught a foreign-speaking student to read and write Thai or even speak Thai. So she would, she didn't know how to start, so she would show me an object like a glass and go, gao, and then she would write it in Thai, the whole word. And, I mean, trying to link letters and sounds, you can't do that. Like, you have to start with the alphabet kind of thing. And so the first day or two was a complete shambles with that. I had no idea what was going on, and eventually we kind of worked out what we needed and went from there. So the first 3 months, it was the language. The people were beautiful. The people are just, you know, Thai people. They have that reputation, and it's really, they really are lovely. But I was also poked and prodded, and I was on display, and I did Thai dancing as well.
That must have been amusing to the locals, was it?
Oh, it was, but they used to put me on the stage, and I used to, every time I learned to Thai dance, they'd dress me up in their Thai traditional outfits for dancing, and they'd put me on stage, and I'd have to perform a Thai dance, and this is in front of the Thai students and the staff and everyone. And here I was, this foreign student for the first time ever doing a Thai dance. And then they'd have, like, I just felt like I was a bit of a goldfish in a fishbowl, but it was all good.
Were they nice about it, or did they?
Oh, they were. They really loved it. There was nothing, there's nothing bad about it in any way. I mean, they laughed with me, not really at me.
So, Leanne, where does the vocation to become a physio come from out of this? Does it come at this time or a bit later?
It was in during my year in Thailand. There was one student in the main city or the main town in my province, in Payal, who, she'd been to America as an exchange student. She was a Thai. And so I befriended her, and she was a few years older, and she'd gone off to work in Chiang Mai at a leprosy hospital. And so I went to Chiang Mai one week to visit her, and I spent a week there with her, and that was where I first saw a physiotherapist at work. They were rehabilitating a Thai patient who had leprosy and had surgery on their hand, reconstructive surgery, and so they were teaching this patient to use their hand again and regain function that this patient hadn't had for years. And I just thought that was pretty cool, and thought it was a nice profession, and it looked really interesting. And so that's when I sort of got the idea to come back. And when I finished school, I went straight into physiotherapy.
At the time there, you're also eating the local food and getting used to that as well.
Absolutely.
Obviously, there's a lot of chili there, and that's fine. We know most of us are used to that.
Yeah.
But any other interesting stuff you tried for the first time, Leanne?
Yeah, I mean, the north of Thailand, the food is there. They have unique food to all the districts, and Thai food in the north of Thailand is traditionally very, very hot, even for the Thais. But I would eat things like, it took me a long time to get used to it, and by the end of my year I was pretty good, but solidified pig's blood was one of the things we used to have with noodles. There was cow wada one day thrown into the noodles.
Yum, cow wada.
Yeah, it was chewy. One afternoon, my Thai friends and I went into a field, and they started digging up these grub things. They looked like giant cockroaches. I didn't eat those. I let them have those. They offered me one, and I think they took them home in a jar from memory, and I don't know what they did with them. But another evening, we had a helper at the house, a servant, and she had a little daughter. And I remember this one evening, we used to sit and eat outside, and they'd eat out over an open coal fire type of thing. And this little girl came out with a fry pan and a broom. And the lights were on outside, and there were swarms of bugs and things flying around the lights at this particular time of year. So with the broom, she swept them down off the wall into the fry pan, whacked it straight on the fire. And so we had an evening of eating these little flying insects. You didn't eat the wings, you held the wings, and you bit off the rest of it. It was kind of like a big ant. But they were okay. They were salty.
Crunchy and tasty and salty.
Yeah.
Well, that's like the locals. So I imagine over time you get a taste for this. What was it like to return back to Australia then after that?
At that time in Thailand, there was very little dairy in Thailand. So for the entire year, I didn't have milk, butter, yogurt, nothing. So, and also there were no phones or anything like that. So I had very little contact with my family back home in Australia. But when I was in Bangkok ready to fly home at the end of my year, I spoke to my mother and I said, and she was flying to Sydney to meet me. And I said to her, look, really what I want is a weekend of eating dairy. So I want scones with jam and cream and I wanted milkshakes and ice cream and all that sort of thing that I'd really missed. So Mum, bless her soul, did that. She organised it for me and I flew into Sydney and my grandparents were living on the Central Coast at the time in Gosford and we went home there and... So they had all that ready and waiting for me and I loved it, but I immediately threw it up.
Sick as a dog, I bet.
Yep, so I ate it and then just threw up. Not because I ate too much, but I was just completely intolerant to the dairy, to the lactose after not having had it for a year. And this went on for the whole weekend until sort of the Sunday afternoon, Mum drove me to Sydney to Chinatown. We went into a Chinese restaurant and I ordered a great big bowl of noodles and whatever, and I was fine.
You were fine.
Yep.
Once you actually then became a physiotherapist, you started working on the Central Coast in Gosford-based hospital. You're enjoying the experience. Then you went to visit your parents and you needed to catch a bus from Gosford to the Gold Coast. Tell me about it. Like, you almost didn't make that bus.
It was during the... This is 1989, and it was during the pilots' strike in Australia, so there were no flights, basically, to get me from Gosford to the Gold Coast, where Mum and Dad were still living. And so I had to catch a bus, and I basically got the last seat on that bus. It had left from Sydney and pulled into Gosford, and so my seat was right down the back of the bus, right in front of the toilet, you know, the one with the where the backrest doesn't recline, the worst seat on the bus.
The worst seat on the bus.
Mm-mm.
And you thought, I don't know what you thought. I was lucky to catch that bus, but the worst seat on it nonetheless.
Yeah, I was heading home for the weekend. It was a long weekend down there in October, and I was going to surprise my parents. They didn't actually know I was coming home.
So the bus trip's going along just fine, and then outside of Grafton is when it collided with that semi-trailer. What do you remember the instant of the crash itself?
I don't remember the actual crash itself. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. I was awake. I had slept fitfully because it wasn't a great seat. And I remember just sitting there looking out and thinking we were going to stop it for breakfast at about 5 or 5:30 in the morning. So I figured I'd just sit there and stay awake. And I remember that right up to that point. And then my next memory is I woke up on the bus and I was lying on the ground. And I actually just thought I was quite comfortable, and at the time I just thought I'd fallen asleep on the floor because my chair was so uncomfortable.
You were comfortable. You said you felt good.
At the time I woke up, I was, yeah. Shock is an amazing thing.
And what happened then? How did you then get a growing awareness of what happened, Leanne?
So I at this point I'd thought that I'd fallen asleep and I looked up, I'd lifted my head to look up and I saw through the bus there was grass and torn metal just above my head there. So I realised then it was all very calm. There was no panic about it. It was really quite interesting and surreal. But I then thought to myself, okay, so we've crashed, the bus has crashed. And then I, being a good health professional, went through and sort of thought, took stock of myself and I took a big breath and I could breathe and I had no pain at the time and I could wriggle my fingers and toes. I went through all of that sort of systematically and thought, okay, well, I'm relatively okay, I'll get up. And then I went to move and I couldn't move. I was pinned down and everything else to me seems very, very dark. I couldn't see too much, but I did see the grass and the torn metal. And I was pinned under a seat that was in front of me, and then I was pinned all over. So I was pinned by chairs and bodies and debris and whatever else.
Were you still inside the bus or thrown clear?
No, I was inside the bus. Yep.
Was it that seat near the toilet that saved your life in a way?
I was very lucky in the end to be in that seat. If there'd been one spare seat on that bus, I would have moved. And in the end, I think that seat probably had a lot to do with saving my life because I was on the right-hand side of the bus, but on the aisle, and everybody else on my side of the bus actually died in that crash, apart from me and the guy in front of me. So the girl next to me died, and the person in front of her and everybody else, right up until the driver. And the driver survived as well. So we were the only ones on that side of the bus who survived. So had I moved, and I mean on the other side of the bus, there were 22 people in all who died in that crash. So it was pretty, it was just a chance thing that I actually walked, you know, survived that crash, I think.
What could you see from that position being pinned down there at the back of the bus?
Not a lot. I remember it was quite dark, it seemed to me. And when I just sort of thought to myself, okay, well, I'm stuck here, I'm pinned down, I can't move, I'll wait. And I just waited. And as I waited, I became more and more uncomfortable because I was aware of, I was lying on glass. I mean, the glass had shattered throughout the whole bus. So it was all down my side. It was everywhere. And so I was uncomfortable. But the only other thing I remember was the seat I was lying under, there was a little boy who was in that seat, and the bus had tipped over on its side, and we'd gone right through a fence, and one of those big old farm fences where the palings and the posts are like sleepers, train rail sleepers, massive things, and he was actually pinned by a sleeper, so he couldn't get out either, but and I think he was coming in and out of consciousness, so when he woke up, he was struggling, but I was pinned under his seat, so the only thing I could do, I couldn't see him, but I could reach around with one arm. I had one arm that was free, and I could pat him and talk to him. And apart from that, I couldn't hear or see anything until the rescuers came.
Did the boy survive?
He did in the end, yeah. I got told later, we had a debrief, I guess, by the accident investigation people, and he told me that the boy had survived. He wasn't in a good way. He'd had skull fractures and he had a leak of cerebrospinal fluid. So he was in and out of consciousness quite a bit. And it was only by chance that the actual SES team who were coming through and saving, you know, pulling people out. And I think they must have been pulling people out as they found them alive. They happened to feel his pulse and take him to hospital. So he did survive, yeah.
What do you remember of the rescue team, the SES arriving?
I remember a flashlight came and like they were searching through the bus and a voice said, "Is anybody down there?" And this flashlight came through and again with my one spare hand I could reach up and wave my hand and said, "Yes, I'm here." And so then there were orders being given, you know, to move things and lift things, and there was a voice behind me, another woman, who said, "Can you get me out? I'm here too." And they managed to pull her out first. And then I remember things being taken off me. So debris was being lifted off, seats were being lifted off, and I have a distinct memory of a body being dragged across my legs. So my legs had been pinned down by another body and that was lifted off. And then the next thing I know, the guys had pulled me up and out off the ground and put me on a stretcher, and they were carrying me out, and I had no idea the extent of the trauma and the chaos and the death associated with this. I really hadn't seen anything up until that point except for feeling this body, and I remember saying to the guys, "Oh, hi, how are you going?" And I got met with stony silence. They didn't say a word. And I think it was just, again, a reflection of the time. No one was prepared in Australia for an accident of that magnitude. And I think what they saw was just horrendous. And the poor guys were just...
shocked.
Yeah.
In shock. They're seeing something like a Holocaust in front of them.
Yeah.
Leanne Bissett is my guest. She's a physiotherapist and she's remembering the Grafton bus crash of 1989. She was one of the few people that survived that crash. How bad were your injuries?
I was very lucky. I didn't walk away, but I sustained a fairly bad whiplash injury from it. But apart from that, cuts and bruises, I had something like 90 odd stitches, and a bit of glass here and there. But they were pulling glass out of my ears and out of my side for weeks afterwards. But apart from that, I was okay.
Leanne, you're obviously a strong person, and afterwards you thought you were fine, but you really weren't, were you? You weren't really fine after the accident.
There was never an opportunity to really debrief, and there was no support, no counselling at the time. I think the systems that are in place today are a lot better than they were back then. So we kind of just had to make do and get along with things the best we could. And so things happened.
Did you need to talk about it with someone? And could you talk about it?
I could, yeah, and I did. I talked about it with everybody, and I think that was probably the best therapy ever. I was quite happy to talk about it. And one of my friends at the time was a photography student. And so she took photos of me, and she's got this wonderful series of me and my injuries after this accident. So I think talking about it was really important.
But there was no counselling as such. And did you make contact with other survivors?
No, there wasn't any opportunity really given for anything like that. Not counselling. I had one assessment session with a psychiatrist, and that was sort of a 1-hour interview. And at the end of that, he just sort of his interpretation or his diagnosis or whatever they write was in the report was mild post-traumatic stress disorder. But that was it. There was no follow-up or anything like that.
And what were some of the symptoms of that if you were experiencing mild post-traumatic stress disorder?
For a long time, and we're talking a couple of years, I would wake up at about 4 o'clock in the morning in a cold sweat, just wake up. No dreams, no anything like that. Just wake up and then I'd be fine. I'd turn her over and go back to sleep at 4 a.m, typically on the dot. And the other probably more bizarre...
Oh, of course, the same time as the accident,
yeah,
in other words.
Yeah, the same time as the accident. And the more bizarre symptom or side effect, I guess, I had was when I got in a car to drive. That was really interesting. And I had no idea, again, what caused this or why I was doing it, and again, I think talking about it and time was sort of the big healer. But I had this, I used to have this urge to, if I was driving on a road along a cliff, or if I was driving along a road and then there was a semi-trailer or a bus or a cement mixer was the other kind of thing, a big truck coming towards me, I would have this urge to drive into the front of these vehicles or off the side of a cliff. And it was a really strong urge. It wasn't just a thought or a fancy. It was like my hands are on the wheel. I could just do this at the last minute. I could turn the wheel and I would be into the front of this vehicle.
Is it like that sensation you get when you sometimes feel when you step right to the edge of a tall building and go, I could just take one step?
Yeah, kind of
like that.
And a temptation. There was a real temptation to it. And it was I could picture in my head what would happen. I would picture my car going into the front of this truck and the truck would drive and the devastation and everything. But somehow or other, I think it was always just that I would be okay. I think it was in my head that I could do this and I'd be okay. And in retrospect, I probably had something like that going on in my head that I thought, well, I'd survive this accident so I could do it again. I could survive. And it was almost like I felt like I wanted to experience what it was because I couldn't remember the actual accident itself.
Well, it's such an interesting thing, isn't it? The human mind is the oddest thing.
It was very bizarre.
Wanting to relive your trauma.
Yeah.
Or part of you anyway.
Yeah.
And part of you standing outside saying, well, this is interesting.
And I never did it. I was conscious enough and sane enough in my mind to know that I could not do that. And the poor people, if anyone was ever in the car with me, they'd be a little panicked because I'd say something. I'd say, wow, see that truck there? I have this really big urge to drive in front. But I never did.
Leanne, having come out of that then, obviously you have to ask yourself the question, once you've recovered, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? What did you decide to do? What did you want?
It was interesting after that. I think I felt like, because so many people had died in the crash, I think I felt like I was living on borrowed time. I should have died too, and I'd almost stolen my life back a little bit. And so I felt like any day now this could happen again or that this could end and it would all be over. And I didn't know how long I was going to be alive for. And it was really, it wasn't scary, but there was an urgency then to my life. So then after that, I finished in Gosford in December and I moved back to the coast and I worked at Tweed Heads Hospital for a few months before heading off overseas. And I headed off overseas and travelled for 4 years.
4 years. And did you work as a physiotherapist while you were travelling?
I did. My first stop was going back to Thailand and I spent 3 months in Thailand. And part of that time I was up in Chiang Mai working back at the Leprosy Rehabilitation Hospital.
Did that help, funnily enough?
Maybe it did. I don't know. I found it really good to go back. Thailand was maybe a bit of an escape for me back to my old life. And I guess treating back the patients that I'd seen originally who first inspired me to become a physio in the first place.
Do you still feel that life is so precarious?
I guess I do to some extent, but not as much. Not such a desperate need anymore because I did a lot of travelling and I saw a lot of places while I was away. So I think to some extent I feel like I've lived a pretty full life up to this point. So, you know, if I died tomorrow, you know, I can go out saying I've had a good time.
It's great you're still here, Leanne.
Yeah, it is. I'm glad.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.